Struggling with your faith? You're not the only one. You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show.
Listening to the Drew Marshall Show. We're streaming live at drewmarshall.ca, and we're live right here in Southern Ontario on Joy 1250. The thrill is gone. I think 5 years ago I may have said that on the show.
Really?
When I
talking about me or in the letter you're going to write me?
That's when I kind of came out about me no longer being a certaintist theologically, spiritually.
Nice. Yes.
And developed a doctrine of doubt.
And you really developed it well.
Thank you. So it's a personal thrill to have this gentleman on the show, Dr. John D. Caputo. He is a philosopher, theologian, Thomas J. Watson Professor of Religious Humanities at Syracuse University, author of Hoping Against Hope, Confessions of a Postmodern Pilgrim. At the risk of boring him with his own bio, I want to read this because there's so much good stuff in it. John D. Caputo has a long career as one of the most, the preeminent postmodern philosophers in America, really. The author of such books as Radical Hermeneutics, be a good name for a punk band. The Prayers and Tears of Jackie Derrida and The Weakness of God, Caputo now reflects on his spiritual journey from a Catholic altar boy in 1950s Philadelphia to a philosopher after the death of God. Part spiritual autobiography, part homily on what he calls the nihilism of grace. Hoping Against Hope calls believers and non-believers alike to participate in the praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, of the kingdom of God, which Caputo says we must pursue without why. See, I've already got 9 questions for him, and I've just read his bio.
Yes. Who is this hermeneutics guy?
He was on the Munsters. Caputo's conversation partners in this volume include a bunch of folks that we'll talk about in a little bit, but let's just get him on the phone right now. He goes by the name of Jack. I think I have a relative, John Marshall, they used to call Jack. Sir, Dr. Caputo, thank you for joining us. What are you in the middle of doing today?
Taking down the Christmas tree.
Well, good for you. It's about time, sir. Are there not needles all over the ground, or is it artificial?
And we wait till the Epiphany, and then we take him down.
Okay. All right. Good. Whereabouts are you?
Very liturgical.
Very well done. I would expect nothing less from you. Whereabouts do you live? What neck of the woods?
I live in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Okay. All right.
I taught at Villanova most of my life. My Syracuse appointment came later on, and I took early retirement from Villanova, where I was in the philosophy department. And then I went to Syracuse in the religion department, but I did not relocate to Syracuse. I used to fly back and forth between Philadelphia and Syracuse.
There are a couple of things in your bio here that obviously stand out for most people. Let's start with the death of God. Does that mean that you're an atheist?
I am an atheist in the sort of garden variety sense. That is, I don't think that there is a supreme being who created heaven and earth, who is outside of space and time and dwells in eternity. But I think the death of that God is the beginning of theology in a more interesting and radical sense. So what I finally tried to do is see if I can talk people out of distinguishing between atheism and theism and think in other terms, in which case what I call radical theology kicks in. So we're no longer talking about sort of garden variety confessional theology, but a more radical sense of, let's say, the theological dimension or the theological depths or the theological sense that life has, even if you don't think that there's a spiritual being up there called God.
Wow. Okay. Radical theology. It sounds like something most of us don't have time for.
Right. I think that actually a lot of people enact it. You know, they perform it. It's in their life. And a lot of times what I find is that I am giving people a vocabulary for something that they have a vague sense of, or maybe not so vague, but some sense of it. And I give them a vocabulary that's useful for midnight meditations, contemplation, cocktail parties, all sorts of things. They can. I'm trying to articulate a lived sense of the depth dimension of existence that people have. They have it in moments of reflection and in moments when they're alone with themselves or in conversation with somebody.
Yeah.
Who matters to them, and they may, you know, they're not professional theologians, but they know, if I can put it right, in the right way, they know what I mean.
So,
a lot of people know what I mean.
So what you're saying is that there is middle ground. You don't either have to be a believer or an atheist, and it's just not this, I don't want to think about it, agnosticism.
Exactly. So then, therefore, it's better not to call it middle ground, because middle ground is agnosticism. Middle ground says, I don't know if God exists or God does. I don't know.
Yeah.
I sort of straddle the fence. That's middle ground. I'd rather call it deeper ground. I sort of burrow beneath the distinctions, dive beneath the waves, and try to come up with a deeper sense of things, which is what the word hermeneutics means, interpretive. So I try to dig beneath the surface description of things to the deeper interpretation of things. So consequently, I speak of radical theology, radical hermeneutics, a radically interpretive discourse, which is trying to get at roots. And that whereas the battles between the atheist and the theist go on up on the surface.
What do you miss, Dr. Caputo, about that old God? After you killed your old God, what do you now miss?
Well, I don't. That's why I say after the death of God. Partly the death of God for me is a kind of strategic thing. It's a maneuver to twist free from classical theology, but it's not a sort of hardball. It's not a hardball atheism. You know, it's trying to sort of recover or repeat what's going on in religion, but without religion. That's an expression that I've taken from Jacques Derrida, religion without religion. So there's something about religion that I have no intention of releasing, and there's something, and that I don't miss it because I never let go of it. And then there's the part of religion that I can let go of, and that's the, well, in the broadest sense, that's the authoritarian sense of religion. And you can either get that in whatever flavor you like. You can get a Catholic flavor of it, in which case you get a pope, or the Protestant flavor, it is biblical fundamentalism, biblical literalism.
Yeah.
In both cases, you've got a very authoritarian notion of religion, where religion thinks that it's got these doctrines that define things and that stabilize religious life and give it certitude. And you were saying you just learned how to doubt 5 years ago, if I heard you.
Yeah.
Right before we got on. So what you do here is you allow the waters of doubt to sort of break up the crust of doctrine and certitude, and that side of religion, the authoritarian, fixed, doctrinal side.
Hold on, I got to repeat that. You just said something gold for me. The waters of doubt, you allow the waters of doubt to break up the crust of certitude, the crust of...
Of certitude, doctrine, dogma,
yeah.
Fixity, you know, the sense that we have propositional grip on the nature of divine reality, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, that's something the mystics know that.
You know,
so you don't have... That's why I always like to quote the mystics, because the mystics will, and the mystics have their own mystical atheism.
But hold on, when you say mystics, some of the Jesus people, you know, think you're talking about Gandalf from, you know, Lord of the Rings and stuff like that. But when you say the mystics, I mean, you're also talking about Christian mystics, like Thomas Merton, are you not?
The great classical mystics. I mean, my own personal favorite is Meister Eckhart, who lived in the 14th century, was a Dominican friar and a theologian, but also a famous preacher who taught some very sizzling hot stuff and got himself into trouble. And he was suspected. I mean, all the great mystics are suspected of atheism, and they are atheists about this God of certitude and propositional rectitude and orthodoxy. They are atheists about that because they've got a deeper sense of what's going on in the name of God. So they're
okay. So
no. So the part of religion I don't miss is the authoritarian part, and that's
sure.
the part that I am constantly giving a hard time to. But I don't try to give a hard time to it in the mode of the new atheist. You know, I'm not writing books called God is Not Great and stuff like that. I'm trying to recover or retrieve or repeat what's going on in religion in a deeper way.
So, listen, it is a rare thing indeed for a philosopher, let alone one of your caliber, who is, of course, an esteemed author as well, to pour their guts out on the pages, to share their personal journey. You guys keep it up in the clouds usually, right? Especially you
right.
academics.
Well, it's one of the advantages of being 75 and retired. You know, I can sort of let it out. There's nothing. I've jumped through all the academic hoops and led a completely sober, professional academic life. And I never wrote in a confessional mode. I did a little bit of confessional writing. There's a certain touch of it. It began to creep in as I got older. But I never wrote anything quite like Hoping Against Hope until after I was retired.
Right. So now that you're retired, you sort of said, you know what? Forget it. I'm writing down what I want to write. What I'm very interested in here, Dr. Caputo, is your turning points. What are the turning points for you over the years?
Well, first of all, the first part of your question was, what's a concise way to put the journey? The journey would be from confessional theology, from Catholic, classical, traditional Catholic theology, confessional theology, to radical theology. Okay? So it's a process of sort of burying deeper down into the deep strata inside the tradition that I inherited. So I didn't try to burn down that tradition. I tried to dig deeper into it and get down below its surface constructions. That's what deconstruction means, to get past those constructions to something deeper. The turning points, there were two major turning points. I mean, to be a young Catholic philosopher in the 50s and 60s was to be a student of Thomas Aquinas. Right? He is the great master of the Catholic tradition,
sure.
and a genius theologian of the 13th century who had many, many, many good things going for him. And so there were basically two turning points from there. That was the beginning. The first was Heidegger, who has gotten himself into... Heidegger's one of these guys that doesn't need enemies. You know, he got himself mixed up with the Nazis, and he really ruined his own name,
sure.
Among a lot of people. But if he can sort of sort through it, he, I think, is the great philosopher of the, at least in continental Europe. I think he's the great philosopher of the 20th century. And he's the guy that sort of rattled my Catholic cage and got me thinking heretical thoughts about traditional religion. And then about 10 or 15 years later, the work of this man, Jacques Derrida, who is, they say, the father of deconstruction. And I found his work more helpful, more a little more plugged into ethics and politics, for one thing, and more suggestive and fertile. But so they were the two. So there were three great shining lights in my firmament.
You know, right. So what I heard you, what I just heard you say was that because of these three minds who wrote down their thoughts, your life changed. In other words, it wasn't because, you know, I had a death in the family, my wife left me, I got cancer. You know, it wasn't because of some personal issues or traumas or whatever.
Nothing that interesting. No.
Well, it was nice chatting with you, Dr. Caputo. Bye-bye.
Spiritual journey.
I was really hoping there'd be some more dirt behind this whole story here. Gee whiz.
Well, maybe, you know, maybe I'll come out with a second edition of Hoping Against Hope and make something up.
Okay. All right. Good. No, but I mean, look, you know, your journey fascinates me, but I can't relate because I haven't had the same cerebral journey that you've had. Mine has been, you know, my journey into doubt. You know, Tony Campolo forced me to put a label on myself one time, and so I said, "Okay, I'm a red letter agnostic theist." Are you okay with that one? What do you think about that, Bubba?
Like that. Yeah,
does that work? Okay.
It's intellectual. I mean, I have no apologies for pursuing an intellectual life.
No, I get it.
One that's plugged into a lot of what's going on in the culture. And right now, with the growing numbers of nuns, N-O-N-E-S nuns, not the nuns who taught me in Catholic grade school, but the N-O-N-E-N-S, the people who just say they have no beliefs at this point in their life, and they're younger people. And I'm saying to them, well, some of that might be true. That is to say, you might have just simply been totally sucked up by a consumerist culture and you don't actually believe anything except in the stock market. But most of them, you know, I think a fair number of them mean they don't believe any of the standard fare that's served up in the mainline churches. They don't believe that anymore. But they believe something. They just don't know what they believe.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to them, okay, well, look at this and think about this and tell me what you think. Do you believe that? And don't you think that that's worthy of belief? And then when I talk like that, I don't use the word belief so much as faith. So I distinguish between the sort of beliefs that people give up when they become nuns and a deeper faith that they really haven't given up, or at least I hope they haven't, because if you give up that kind of faith or that kind of hope, you've sort of given up, period. You know, and then you're left with just empty consumerism and self-aggrandizement and me first, and you know, there's nothing left to be.
You know, a guy that I've had some just fantastic conversations with over the years, Dr. Daniel Taylor, who wrote The Myth of Certainty. As a matter of fact, one of his lines is a sort of a tagline for our show, that doubt is more compatible with faith than certainty. How does that sit with you?
Oh, that's the truth. Yeah. That's the truth. If I, you know, if not to be, if I may be permitted to put it that way, I'm absolutely certain that's true.
Yeah.
It's right. I mean, because faith is faith only in the face of doubt. When you insulate yourself off from doubt, then you've got a self-certitude that's not faith anymore. Proportional to the incredibility of what you believe, you know. Insofar as the thing is credible and clear, you don't need much faith for that because you can see it. Faith has to do with what you can't see.
Okay, in your blurb here, there's one thing that makes my head turn sideways. Well, there are a few things, but let me bring this one up. Hoping Against Hope calls believers and non-believers. This is Dr. Caputo's book, Hoping Against Hope. Calls believers and non-believers alike to participate in the praxis of the kingdom of God, which Caputo says we must pursue without why. Now, Dr. Caputo, my entire life has been built on the word why. In grade 7, I was asked to leave my school and go to another one because I asked why too much.
Good for you. Okay, in that sense of why, we want why. We want, in the face of authority, we want why. But when you, there's a point at which you stop asking why, and that is if you are sort of led by a resolute interrogation of things, the way, which is what the word, the purpose that the word why serves. If you're led by this interrogation of things to the point of finding things that are valued in themselves and of themselves and for themselves, and those are the things that are without why. So if I said to you, why do you love to use this expression, without why, comes from Meister Eckhart. It's a mystical expression. And he said that love is without why. That is to say, if you ask someone, why are you studying hard? It's because I want to graduate and I want to get a good job. And why do you want to get a good job? Well, because I want to be able to live comfortably, etc. But there's some point at which you have to say, well, why is all that? Well, why do you care about any of those things? Well, then you hit the thing that is without why, and one of those things that is without why is love.
That's amazing. I'm sorry to sound like an ignorant putz here, but love is without why is one of the most brilliant short sentences I've heard in a long, long time. And this is something, that's a world you swim in, but this is new for me. Love is without why. Why am I getting so excited about that?
Meister Eckhart. I mean, I wish I had come up with it, but it's and there's a series of things that are like that. You know, these things that are, that's what I mean by the depth dimension or ground of life. Right. These streams or elements or moments of life that are valued in and of themselves. Right. And then here's the kicker. Here's where I pull the trigger. What you do next is put that to religion. And that's what's going on in Hoping Without Hope. Because religion describes itself as an economy of salvation. That is to say, all the things you got to do in order to get rewarded with eternal rewards. And that utterly undermines whatever it is you're being asked to do. Because the whole system of eternal rewards and eternal punishments undermines the very thing that it's supposed to be about, which is to say that God is love. Well, if God is love, God is without why. If God is without why, then God is not a supreme punisher and rewarder. That's what happens in the stock market. That's not what happens in with love.
Oh, okay. We're running out of time, and I've got 37 questions to ask you in 2 minutes. So I gotta just pull apart, please, the nihilism of grace, because that's another phrase that's spun my head today.
Yeah, that means that life is without why. That our, you know, so people say, well, look, you know, 500 million years from now, the Earth is going to be toast, and hundreds of trillions of years from now, I don't know what the number would be, the whole universe is just going to go kaploom, you know, it's going to end up in entropic dissipation, there'll be nothing left, and that makes our life meaningless. And I say, no, it doesn't. It doesn't make our life the least bit meaningless. It means that for this one shining moment in this corner of the universe, there are trees and there are flowers and there are people and there are children and there is love and there is life. And it makes it all the more precious. And so if you had this sort of cosmic nihilistic view of the universe, I say, well, that makes this moment of life on Earth a grace. Okay? It's the grace. What is a grace? A grace is a gift, and the gift is without why. It's the preciousness of this moment that we have right now. It's like two lovers in the night who know that who cling to each other through the night all the more tightly because they know that in the morning they must part. doesn't destroy that night. It makes the night all the more precious. That's the nihilism.
Wow. Okay. I mentioned this earlier in the show. A friend of mine and I have had these discussions about this sentence. We've been talking about the seekers, those that are continually seeking. You know, they're wondering and they're seeking and they're exploring this group and that group and this belief system and this cadence and this credence and this. Anyway, by definition, shouldn't seekers land or want to land, or are seekers always seekers?
Seekers are always seekers. When the seeking's over, the only thing left to do is call the funeral power.
That's so interesting, because my whole life I've really felt I've been seeking because I've been looking for a place to land. But I've been challenged.
It would be like a living thing to stop growing. I mean, when living things stop growing, they're either dormant or dead.
But I can seek within the landing zone. That just sounds weird.
Well, you have pauses. You know, there are moments of pausing when you sort of regroup and stabilize what you've gathered, but then it goes on, you know, and then whatever you've stabilized starts to get destabilized, and you keep going because, I mean, it's like science. Modern science, contemporary physics, it was relatively stable at the end of the 19th century, and now it's going bananas. I mean, there's so many things being discovered about the universe, and so many wild possibilities being opened by quantum theory, and so many wild things going on about the expansion of the universe and the possibility of alternate universes. So it's a great example of seeking that keeps making the search more expansive, and the search keeps getting wilder.
You know, there's only one thing that gave me pause when it came to having you as a guest on the show, and it's the fact that your foreword was written by a cheeky Irish boy.
Yeah, he's a very good friend of mine. He's a good man. Have you had him on the show yet?
Yeah, he's been on a few times. Peter Rollins. He is a pain in the butt. When I listen to him, like, you know, both you and he have this spiritual gift of deconstructionism. And I like it, but then I'm not smart enough to stay with it for very long. So I'm sorry, is what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry that you're friends with Peter Rollins, and I'm sorry.
I'll be sure to tell him.
Please do. No, listen,
He's got a gift for putting all of this in the form of stories.
Yeah.
And that's a special gift.
So he takes what you say and dumbs it down? Is that what I'm hearing?
He's got his own mind, and he also has a much more psychoanalytic twist than I do. He's got a lot more confidence in psychoanalysis. And, I'm not against it, you know, but that's the twist that he gives it. But
that's his milieu.
We go in the same direction, and we have the same. We're fellow travelers.
Yeah. Well, and of course that brings me to the title of one of your other books, which I will be hunkering down into. What Would Jesus Deconstruct? WWJD. Love it.
Yeah, that was a book that had to be written as soon as I thought of the title.
Yeah, that's right.
It was such a great title. I thought, my God, there's got to be a book that goes with that.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Caputo, certainly not enough time, but I appreciate your time. So thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been fun.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So people get ready for the train.